Forty Towers is not big.
Hey everybody, we'll kick off the last session before we get to the closed session. Agenda paper 7 covers something that we've talked about here. And there's always been great consensus. Say that with irony. So it's business combinations, and it's over to you, Carla.
Maybe I will just say a couple of opening remarks to make sure we're all on the same page, and then leave it to Carla and Simona.
Yeah, I think it's a very good idea.
So first of all, just to remind everyone why we're doing this project, and this is illustrated on slide 8 in agenda paper 7. So today we have guidance in IFRS 3 that guides the accounting for business combinations between unrelated parties. And under IFRS 3, the acquiring entity will recognize the acquired business and current values. We don't have any standard in IFRS for business combinations under common control. And what entities do in practice, they either use current value accounting as set out in IFRS 3, or they use predecessor historical amounts. So what we're considering in this project is whether a current value approach or a predecessor historical approach should be applied to business combinations under common control and in which cases. Now, the other point I would like to highlight, as illustrated on slide 9 in agenda paper 7, that in this project we are looking at the financial statements of the receiving entity or acquiring entity. We're not looking at any other parties of the transactions. And when we look at the financial statements of the receiving entity, so the entity that acquires a business under common control, we are considering information needs of primary users of this entity's financial statements, so investors, lenders and other creditors, and prospective equity investors. Now, we have already discussed this project with CMAQ and also with other stakeholders, and I think it's fair to say that initial feedback we have received so far has been largely consistent, not uniform, but largely consistent. And what we've heard so far is that for transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity, current value information would be useful, would be a good approach to explore. So there is a caveat that maybe current value information should only be provided if NCI is substantive, whatever that means, and we would like to explore it a little bit more with you today. Now, we've received a largely consistent feedback that for transactions between wholly owned entities, if there is no NCI, predecessor historical information would be good information, even if such transactions are undertaken in preparation for an IPO. And again, we would like to walk you through our thinking on this today and see what you think. And lastly, you may remember that we discussed with you in June information needs of lenders and creditors in a business combination under common control. And at that meeting, we heard mixed feedback. And since then, we performed further outreach and further analysis. So we'd like to present you with our updated analysis and seek your input. So the good news is that we only have 3 questions in the session, not 11 questions. And I guess it would be better if we take questions one by one, first talk about NCI, then talk about lenders and creditors, and then talk about prospective equity investors. And with that, I hand it over to Carla to hear the first question.
Thank you, Yulia, and good afternoon, CMAQ members. So I'm not going through the entire deck, but rather focus on essential points leading up to our questions. So as Yulia noted, in June, most CMAQ members supported using a current value approach for BCUCC, at least when NCI is considered substantive. And this is consistent with the direction taken by the board. The question then arises whether a current value approach should be used in all transactions that affect NCI or only some. And if only some, how that distinction could be made. On balance, we think that the current value approach should only be applied to some transactions that affect NCI. This is partly because the benefits of providing current value information may not always justify the cost. For example, consider a public entity with significant NCI versus a private entity with where a few stock options are issued to key management personnel. In addition, requiring current value information to all NCI scenarios, but not for transactions between wholly owned entities, could give rise to structuring opportunities. That is, an entity could effectively choose which approach to apply by issuing or buying back a few stock options. The question then becomes, in which NCI scenarios should current value information be provided? We have considered both a qualitative and a quantitative approach in making a distinction and a combination of the two. So this is presented in, these are presented in slide 17.
17?
17,
okay.
Yeah. On balance, we think that a distinction based on whether NCI is publicly held is a viable approach to pursue. This is because it will implicitly capture only substantive NCI due to minimum listing requirements in many jurisdictions, and it would be least open to structuring opportunities. Our observations on transactions that affect NCI are summarized on slide 18. And with that, do you agree with our observations?
So if there are any questions that you have for us to clarify our thinking, we would be happy first to answer those questions.
Paolo, is your card?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, no cards are up yet, so maybe some more clarification on in 18 would be helpful, unless there's anyone who's got a specific question for clarification.
Okay, so I think at a very high level, there are two questions we need to answer with respect to NCI, as Carla noted. So first of all, do we require current values in all scenarios where non-controlling shareholders are present or only some? And we think there is a difference between a scenario where you have 30, 40, 45% NCI, let's say in a public entity, as opposed to, family-owned business, wholly owned, and there are a few employee stock options issued to key management personnel. So we think there is a difference in terms of the whole cost-benefit consideration. So in principle, we think that current value information would be useful to all non-controlling shareholders, but the cost-benefit consideration can be different. Our other concern relates to structuring opportunities. Remember, the whole point of this project is to reduce or eliminate diversity in practice. And today, entities are able to choose either the predecessor method or a current value method. And we are mindful that if we were to require a current value approach in all scenarios that involve NCI, all a company has to do is issue a few employee stock options and get to current value accounting, or if they already have a few shares or options outstanding, they buy them back and they get to historical cost accounting. So that's why we think making a distinction based on whether any NCI is present is not a good approach, and somehow we need to capture only substantive NCI. So that's the first question. Mm-hmm. And then the second question is, okay, then how do we capture this substantive NCI?
So it may just be worth going back to the picture on slide 9, just our basic picture, just to remind everyone that in this scenario, we're talking about the accounts for company A.
Yes.
And we're saying here that there's a non-controlling interest in company A.
Yes.
And it's about whether we are recognising the assets and liabilities from company C at current values or predecessor values.
Exactly.
Okay, just so everyone's on the same page.
Okay. Osman, did you want to...
Can I ask a clarifying
question? Yeah, please. That's what round.
Since you put forward the cost argument against the current value accounting, why would somebody structure to go for that method? I understand what you said, that they would buy back the stuff so that they can go historical cost, but you also said the risk exists that they just issue some of these things and then they have to do current value accounting. Why would they want to do that?
It is our understanding that in some circumstances and in some jurisdictions, entities could get a better tax result, you know, leading back to our previous discussion, by applying a current value accounting.
That makes sense.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of keep it simple for my mind in the sense of, you're talking about, as the title says, business combinations under common control. Common controlling shareholder, you have NCI, right? Why is there an implicit assumption that NCI, if there's an NCI presence, current value accounting is better? What's underlying that assumption?
So I think there are a few things underlying that assumption. So first of all, we already have, as I noted, IFRS 3 that requires current value accounting for normal business combinations under common control. And of course, in developing, what did I say, sorry? That requires current value for normal business combinations, yes? And of course, in developing that standard, the board followed due process and made sure that this information is useful. Then this sort of assumption, if you will, or the starting point, is supported by the feedback we've received on the project so far. And again, it's maybe not anonymous, but it's pretty consistent that if you have non-controlling shareholders, current value information would be useful to the shareholders. And then I suppose, lastly, sort of applying common logic, if you use historical information, assuming that there is no further disclosure, there is no way for you to see if the exchange in a business combination under common control was fair. So there are a few things here.
Yeah, I think that fairness point is where I kind of, perhaps wrongly, but struggle a little bit, because the key for me is that common control element. And in terms of the transaction price, that's decided, I guess, not from the accounting, but from the underlying valuation process. So I'm not sure that the purchase price allocation would be helpful for NCIs. I'm just trying to kind of fully understand where we're going with this.
And it's a very fair point. So, of course, and that's why I keep using the language current value as opposed to acquisition method. So, of course, if we pursue this current value approach for transactions that affect NCI, we will need to think about whether the acquisition method needs to be modified, and if so, how it needs to be modified. So, for example, in those three circumstances where you paid less than fair value of the acquired business, so in a normal business combination, you will recognize a gain. But under common control, I think there is an argument that it's essentially a contribution, so that's one potential modification. There may be an argument to consider some sort of screening mechanism. Well, if there is a clear overpayment, is there a way to sort of capture it somehow? But that's maybe a little bit going a little bit too far at the moment. So we will come back to you with how to apply a current value approach in those circumstances when it is implied. But for now, the question is more about how to draw the line in the best possible way. And perhaps I should also note that no line will ever be ideal. Any sort of distinction between different types of transactions will be imperfect. But I think our ambition is to find the best possible distinction that provides useful information, least open to structuring opportunities, and costs are justified by the benefits.
So I think if I had to go answering your first question about the staff observation requiring a current value approach for BC UCCs that affect NCIs, I don't think I'm fully convinced. I think from a simplicity, understandability perspective, you know, maybe the predecessor value approach works in this type of transaction.
And do you think predecessor approach would be better for NCI?
I don't think it'd be any worse than the current value approach. I'm still not convinced of what they would get out of this current valuation approach for NCIs.
Okay, so it's not better, but it's not worse. And considering the costs, you think that on balance it might be better. Is this a fair? Okay.
In a way, it's more a question to you, Usman. Let's assume that company A, that happens all the time in Brazil, company A merges companies B and C. For the sake of the argument, they are twins, absolutely equal. In one, A has 51% in control. In the other one, A has 49% and doesn't control. And then you merge the two companies into A with different standards. Doesn't sound strange.
If you follow that argument through, then you would say, let's use current value accounting for every type of business combination under common control.
No, I agree with the concept of the technical team that in some cases it doesn't make sense. But in many of them, it does make sense. Because actually it's a business combination. And the fact that the two companies are under common control doesn't change this picture. So there's a problem we have in our country quite often, that is doing a business combination, and all of a sudden, no, you can't treat this as a business combination. I acknowledge, addressing your question, that in many cases you do that only for tax purposes, because doing at current value, you may create a substantial goodwill. And if, as it's the case in many countries, including Brazil, it can be amortized for tax purposes. So this kind of trick is extremely useful, if I may. But in many cases, actually, you are streamlining your company, and then you create this situation. In some cases, you apply IFRS 3, and some which are very similar, you don't. That's the problem we have now.
But in the non-similar case where you're not applying IFRS 3, am I not right in thinking that you have those assets and liabilities valued on the same aligned accounting policies of the whole group as a whole? So why would you then change? You're controlling that company. You're still ultimately controlling that company. What's changed to move to a current value approach? Whereas for the 49% interest, actually, you're now consolidating those
assets.
But
you're not using, I mean, it's the current fair value in both cases. You're using historical value. You're doing consolidation for that purpose, but I mean, so, using historical value. And that's why, I mean, so, that's a fair question. That's why I went directly to the merger,
yeah,
and not to the acquisition.
Okay.
But then you don't have a company any longer.
Okay. Tom?
Just a question for Osman. If wouldn't it be helpful if, in assessing the consideration that the one subsidiary paid to the other? Because you could sort of get a look at what you were getting. So one case they paid $1 million, one case they paid $1.2 million. You'd get some inclination about what was coming over. As opposed to in both, if you just do predecessor, all that comes over is the book values, right?
If I made a problem is that usually you're not paying, just because, I mean,
even if it's shares, it could be shares.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, you're giving up shares worth, because the subsidiary's traded, so the shares have a value. Mm-hmm. So you're giving up $1.2 million in shares versus $1 million in shares. You might get some indication about what it is that you're getting. I'm not sure, but I think that's one of the reasons you might want to do that.
So maybe I'm too simplistic, because to me that's implying that the accounting is driving the valuation of the business that you're acquiring, and I'm not convinced that would be the case. You know, the value of the business that you're acquiring is the value that you're willing to acquire it for. The accounting, I think, would follow as a secondary consideration, but maybe that's not.
I agree the accounting follows. I just, yeah. To me, if you're a minority or a non-controlling interest, you might get an inference about how legitimate that valuation was.
Nick, did you want to chime in?
I guess let's say you spend $100 million or something, and you take your acquired assets across a book value, which may be 20, and it's a historic number, doesn't really tell you anything. I think the argument is, if you do that, go through that revaluation exercise of the identifiable, separately identifying assets, you may find that actually those come to 60. There's still a gap, because we don't value everything, but that 60 is a current up-to-date value on the basis of some valuation methodology, and there may be more information than the 20 of historic cost. I think that's the argument.
No, that's the point, because if it's a traded company, as you mentioned, under common control, you're going to pay for market value.
Yeah.
But then, the moment you do that, and if you're not using a fair value, then you create a huge goodwill, and you have to explain. That's the point. It's a strange situation where you actually purchase something for 10, and I mean for 1,000. Historical cost is 10, and you haven't explained this. Look, why did you pay 990 for that if you can't account for that? It's a huge distortion you create, and then all of a sudden you see funny ideas like that was goodwill. and I'm going to amortize that.
All the more traumatized for you.
Well, absolutely. If that's goodwill, then let's amortize it. And that's the problem we have. I mean,
But
I'm just a little bit confused. Are you talking about predecessor accounting or current value accounting? Like, I'm not sure basically which position you're supporting.
No, no, I'm saying that if you don't apply what you're suggesting is fair value current, if you apply predecessor, and predecessor has a huge gap between market value, and you're paying market value because there are minority shareholders, and even if their companies are under common control, then you have to explain the difference between historical cost and market value, which you cannot book for.
Are
you,
so you're supporting current value? In
absolutely.
Okay.
What you were trying to explain is why someone would use historical. Is that what you're trying to explain?
No, no. Why, if you have to use historical costs, the kind of problems that you will create with that.
Got it.
In a way, the kind of quote-unquote solutions this thing will generate tax-wise.
Okay. Peter.
I'm still, I don't want to take this discussion too far, but I'm still trying to get to this choice of accounting method that seems to be present. And it's a clarifying question. I don't know the answer. I'm very tired. Does the presence of debt in the capital structure have anything to do with it?
No. At the moment, there is no standard.
No, but I mean, two companies under common control with external debt holders, the choice of accounting in terms of bringing these together, does it alter anything to the wealth of debt in the capital structure? Does it change, for example, dividend paying ability of the merged company at the expense of the debt holders, things like that? Are those considerations that are being made in these conditions?
So that's actually going a little bit into our second question, which is what would be useful information about such transaction to debt holders. But again, we are looking just at the acquiring entity, not to the acquired entity, because acquired entity, it remains as it was. It still has whatever it owns and whatever it owes to external parties. It does not really affect the acquired company.
Well, but it could be that the accounting changes dividend paying ability of the acquiring entity, right?
But not of the acquired. Yeah, I think if you made a really bad investment as an acquiring company, it can affect all sorts of things. But then
it could. I think that's very difficult territory for us to get into, because obviously those dividend rules would differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But it, in theory, under some circumstances, it could, I guess.
I didn't want to take us all the way there, but I'm just trying to think why people make choices between these two methods.
In relation to taking into account the asset side, assuming that the company under common control is following IFRS to start with. I mean, the debt should be fair value. Mm-hmm. It should. So the moment you do that, the debt side should not change that much.
Okay.
But the asset side, I mean, there's could be a dramatic change.
Working capital and things like that.
So it sounds like there's, I mean, sorry, Terrence, apologies, please.
Sorry, yeah, I mean, your proposed approach to say it's required where it's kind of like a listed or publicly held NCI seems to have come about because we don't want to give companies, we want it to be, initially we don't want to make companies do it because there could be a cost if it's very, very small. We don't want to make them do it and spend the money, but then we don't want them to have the choice of picking one that's more beneficial than the other. And so, therefore, by default, we go for the one where it's kind of a listed NCI because that kind of avoids all those other issues. Is that the right way to come to this conclusion?
Is your question related to how we've sort of...
It's almost like it's a scenario analysis where we've said, right, we don't want to do it where it's going to hurt a company and there's no real good reason for it if they've got a tiny NCI and it's not publicly listed or whatever. So we don't want them to have to do it. So we want it to be substantial. But then there's an argument, what's substantial? And so then it's saying, okay, if it's listed, it's there for substantial. It's almost as if like we're trying to avoid certain scenarios to get to, and that's why we arrive at this one.
I don't think we're trying to avoid certain scenarios. So I think as you know, if I take a step back, as we said earlier, we think that if we were to say, well, current value applies to all NCI scenarios, we think it's really non-starter. Because if you have 0.00001 NCI, we say, well, current value information. So cost versus benefit does not really work. So that's the first reason. The second reason is structuring opportunities. So I think our sort of first conclusion is, well, we can't really require and we shouldn't require current value in all scenarios. We need to somewhere draw the line. We need to somehow establish when NCI is substantive. And then the next logical questions that you have, well, how do you establish when it is substantive? And in theory, you could do only one of two things. You can either have a qualitative line, and you're saying, well, one type of NCI gets this treatment, another type of NCI gets this treatment, or you can have a quantitative line, and you could say, okay, if it's more than 20%, you do current value. If it's less than 20%, you can do, you know, you do historical. There is no other way. It's either qualitative approach or quantitative or a combination. When we thought about it, and we had a whole sort of paper exploring it, we thought quantitative is non-starter. It's a bright line. There is no concept. And by, again, issuing a few options or buying back a few options, I can cross the lines the way I want. So quantitative is non-starter. Then you're left with a qualitative approach. And then, okay, well, again, how do you make this distinction? Do we say that if it's a related party of the acquiring entity, you do historical information, but everyone else gets current value? Again, there are sort of difficulties with this approach. So I think by considering all the possible options, where we landed, that this traded, non-traded distinction could be the least evil, because you can't really structure around it very easily. It does indirectly capture the quantitative perspective, not by setting a bright line, but because many jurisdictions have minimum listing requirements. By looking just at traded entities, you sort of capture this quantitative percent. So that was our thought process in sort of arriving to our observations. I'm not quite sure. I'm very conscious of time. So we've been about half an hour, and we have two more questions. And I'm not quite sure how to interpret the silence, whether it's more agreement, whether it's more disagreement, or...
Whether it's a very complicated topic late in the day might be another one.
We don't see many of these transactions.
And I think that's perfectly anecdotal. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please, Rosemary.
No, I didn't think it was a lot complicated at the end of the day.
I think I was.
Yeah.
It's going to feel like it in about an hour or so, I got to tell you that. If it doesn't now. I think part of it is that it's difficult. This is very nebulous in a way. I don't know others, but I don't have a lot of tangible experience with this at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, normally it's like, just make it when it's material. It's got to be current value when it's material. But you've thrown up some sort of complication that I don't really understand, because it can be manipulated. Uh-huh. And I would say, okay, we'll make a current value, and if they manipulate it, then they can't do that and make a current value. So it's really unhelpful comment. But Jeremy,
just a question. I agree
with all. You know,
I was just wondering, have you looked at how the tax authorities treat it from a tax-based perspective? So if you have an NCI in slide 9 that's transferred across, does the tax base change at all?
It will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In that respect, it's impossible for us to get in. You know, at least our standards are used in 144 different countries, or can be used around the world.
There's no consistency at all.
Yeah, and so what happens in Brazil will be very different from what happens in China.
The relevant point there is that, you well know that in some cases you pay taxes based on consolidated financial statements. In some cases, you are not allowed to publish individual financial statements. So this change from country to country.
Okay, Marietta.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's also quite an abstract topic I don't have much experience with, but I mean, just like listening to everything, the traded versus non-traded suggestion really sounds like a very good one, because I think my rule of thumb would be that you don't want the accounting tail to wag the business decision-making dog. So I think, you know, if you do have like 40% NCI or something, there was probably, you know, I mean, you're not going to suddenly somehow try to get rid of that just because you're unhappy with the accounting requirements. But equally, you know, if you basically have an obligation to go to current value as soon as you have an NCI, then, you know, maybe they don't want to issue a stock option to some really important tech guy who's really important for the business. And, you know, that means that they have massive talent retention issues and can't go down a certain route or something like that. So I think the traded versus non-traded is probably the best way to approach this.
Okay. Thank you. Jin Chao.
Thank you. Just to want to confirm, Paulus, you just mentioned you support the current value approach. One of the reasons, if those BCUCC transaction, and we propose that precise method to account for those transactions, you say the difference is between the consideration the receiving entity paid and the assets, you know, and the liability acquired from the acquiring business. All those differences will go to the goodwill, and you're worried about that, the goodwill issue or something like that. I just want, actually, under presented method, if under presented, all those differences normally will go to equity, will be deducted from the equity. So will, in my understanding, there will be no goodwill will be recognized. Of course, there will be no impairment or amortization. Subsequent accounting issue will come up. So this, I just want to confirm, because you just now you mentioned your concern about the, there will be a very big goodwill will be recognized, and there.
Yeah, I'm assuming that the moment you do a transaction like that, it's, of course, I mean, it's, you have two different publics, if you will. One, yourself, actually, yeah. A substantial part, at least control of the company you already own. And then you have, say, at the limit, 49%, that you're going to either pay in cash, and you're not doing a business combination. Let's assume what actually happens. And that's why the listed standard might be a concern. This problem really arises when you do a merger, and actually when you merge a controlled company. And then, well, of course, you're going to issue shares for the minority shareholders, and you have to do that, taking into account the actual value of the 49%, if you will. The moment you do that, actually, you incorporate assets and liabilities, but you paid more than the historical value.
Yeah.
And then what do you do with the balance if you're not using the business combination standards?
Yeah, this is, I think, actually, if on the present method, the carrying amount of those assets and liability automatically will be, you know, moved to the receiving entity's consolidated financial statement. And what you worry about is how to account for those differences, because you pay more money, maybe, and more than the
right. You're already doing
so the difference. Yeah, so the difference is on the presentation method.
Maybe just finish up that last comment, and then we'll move on because we've got a bit more to cover.
Okay, so confirm what you really worry about. You worry about the differences, how to account for those differences, or whether. Any other concerns you have?
That's right, I mean, so you're paying more than historical value because you have to take into account the minority shareholders, and then all of a sudden there's a big difference in value for the 49%.
Maybe just to close this discussion, just one observation. There is, because there is no standard on predecessor accounting, there is no consistency in how it is applied. And of course, in many cases, it goes to equity. But again, there is a.
I said normally, current practice normally so in some jurisdictions they are doing this kind of, what's the meaning of the precession method? Actually, of course, normally well, no goodwill will be recognized because this is the precession value. Actually, no goodwill will be recognized. I just confirmed that.
Okay, good.
So we have two more questions, yep. And I think if we could cover one of them, that would be brilliant. If we could cover both of them, that would be perfect.
We'll get them both.
So if we move to the lenders and creditors.
Yes. We are next moving to lenders and creditors. Agenda paper 7A explores information needs of lenders and other creditors and discusses the implication of debt analysis for BCUCC. Slides 20 to 22 summarize our observations. Based on our research and outreach, we observe that lenders and other creditors can have different information needs depending, for example, on industry focus or the level of sophistication, and different level of access to information beyond the information provided in general purpose financial statements. However, we have identified common features of credit analysis and the information is used in that analysis. We noted that debt providers and credit analysts focus on the entity's ability to service the existing debt and to raise new debt. Accordingly, core prediction models used in credit analysis tend to focus on cash flow analysis and on the total gross debt, including unrecognized commitments and contingent liabilities. Based on how debt investors and credit analysts process information, we think that the result of those users' analysis on the ability of an entity to service and raise debt would not depend greatly on whether a current value approach or a predecessor value approach is applied to account for BCUCC. Our observations are summarized in paragraph 29 to 31 of the appendix to Agenda Paper 7 and slide 22. And at the end, do you agree with our observations?
Yes and no. Wouldn't be a good credit analyst if I didn't have no opinion. I think that from a cash flow point of view, you're right. I think from, you know, the on one hand, enterprise value is illusory and has no reflection of the cash generative abilities of a company. However, there is a credit risk linked to the estimated value of a business, and that's the distance between net leverage and the leverage multiple and the enterprise multiple. So EV over net debt. The difference between net debt and enterprise value or EBITDA is implied equity, and so there is, you know, if that entity is valued at current value, and per Apollo's point, that gap is very high, implies that actually the credit risk of the business is maybe lower than one thinks, because the value of that business is thought to have been from a market value point of view a lot higher. So I think it's in some ways sort of secondary, but you know, always it's going to be cash. You know, the first thing is going to be liquidity risk, you know, debt service, and all these factors, and mm-hmm. you know, the market perception or the secondary opinion of the value. You know, the market perception of the value is neither here nor there. But I will say that implied equity, that distance between net leverage and EV to EBITDA, can be important in terms of credit risk. It does sometimes give that entity the ability to, if it's a wide gap, to actually add more debt onto the entity, because if that gap widens, it's like, hey, it's the enterprise value is not 3 times, it's 10 times. We can lever up to 7 times and still have a 30%, you know, margin before we get to 100% loan to value.
Can I ask
if that makes any sense?
Can I ask a clarification? Just so I understand, there may be an assumption that I just want to flesh out. Mm. So your EV is based on the market capitalization and the debt.
Yes.
Okay. And behind that, then I'm just trying to work out how whether current values in terms of the accounts versus book values. You're assuming one has more influence on the market value than the other. That if you have current values, you end up with a higher market value. That's the assumption.
Yes.
To be clear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the current value should, in theory, most accurately reflect where that would trade in the market value. Is that?
I'm not sure it happens in practice, is my idea.
Yeah. But it will be higher than historical value.
I'm not sure it necessarily determines market capitalization. I think it's cash flow.
It's an implied. It's an implied market. It's, what you're trying to get to is enterprise value, you know. And you.
Okay. I'm not sure.
Okay. All right.
I just want to check the assumption.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Maybe.
Philip.
Thank you. I'm probably going to agree a little bit more. You know, I think the overall conclusion is pretty good. You know, we see transactions like this under current value approach. We see them under predecessor approach. You know, we deal with it. We have the information there that we need, and we can carry on rating them. I don't know how widely circulated the slides are going to be, but just have a couple of comments, maybe just on some of the things in the slides.
Yes.
On slide 21. You know, you say capital structure of the entity rather than overall leverage. You know, I think overall leverage is always important, so I'd probably disagree maybe with that point. And then maybe more importantly on slide 22, where you say credit analysis doesn't tend to focus on the statement of financial position. I'm not a big fan of that statement at all. So, you know, I think, again, credit analysis always is going to be looking at the statement of financial position. So, but other than that, you know, I think where you've got to in the overall conclusion is pretty accurate. And, you know, that's why in the first question I didn't really partake, because I don't have a strong view, to be honest, in terms of usefulness for credit analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
I just wanted to flag one scenario, and I don't know how realistic that is, but could we actually potentially also be looking at scenarios where actually the fair value or current value is lower than the predecessor value and actually somehow reveals credit risk that you're not aware of if you show the predecessor value, and this might actually have implications in scenarios where you really need to sell assets in order to get the company to survive, basically, or where at least maybe fair value has once again fallen below the levels that were assumed the last time the financial statements were prepared. And then you could potentially end up in a situation where, the whole thing, goes horribly wrong and the debt investor is out of pocket. And then if that debt investor is something politically sensitive, like, let's say, a government, and at the end of the day, the taxpayer, there might be sort of like, a reputational risk in the sense that, newspapers might write, well, equity investors, hedge funds, they get all of the relevant information. But of course, for a debt investor like the government and the taxpayer, they don't really go to all that trouble. And so basically, just a scenario where you have a lot of negative press around the effects that, you might have afforded sort of less protection because you've given less information to a debt investor than an equity investor. And again, I'm not familiar enough with the space to really be able to say what the risk of that happening in practice is, or to even dream up a really realistic scenario. But I'm just wondering if it could happen, especially in these sorts of complicated structures where, that's probably a reason it's under common control, and it happens sort of probably in certain sectors and jurisdictions where, things are quite complicated to begin with and your lender is not just sort of like, a run-of-the-mill merchant bank.
It's probably worth for us thinking about. I guess my sort of initial reaction to your starting point is that normally we wouldn't have historical values above fair values or historical amounts of fair values because we have impairment test requirements in IFRS. So anything that is too high will have been written down. I don't know if it sort of makes a difference for the rest of your sort of considerations, but we will have a think. Yeah.
The figure of reverse merger in your scenario becomes reality because you have the company, the surviving company, which is under common control, has tax loss carry forwards. And then you want to preserve these tax loss carry forwards. And then you merge the healthy company into the other one. And then you have your snare.
Okay.
Austin.
I'll be brief in conscious of time. But, just with regard to your question on what you've said on slide 22, definitely agree with it. I think when we spoke a few months back, I think what we kind of outlined is this is the case, but the other part of the jigsaw, why it's kind of less relevant, what valuation you use in this scenario. If I just turn back to slide 9, our analysis generally starts at that controlling company level. So we have that group analysis, we have the group consolidated balance sheet. And then for the subsidiary ratings, we really considered the interlinkages between the group and the sub. And it's we couldn't come up with circumstances where we'd seen a business combination under common control where we hadn't treated the sub as a core part of the group and assumed with reason group support. So the notching that we applied to the subsidiary rating really reflected the overall group position plus additional risks. And that's kind of the other reason why, you know, everything that you said on slide 22, that it doesn't really matter, is quite a key reason for us.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, so...
Make it done. That means we've knocked off 2 or 3, so...
Get to the third one.
Question?
Yeah.
So let's talk about prospective equity investors in an IPO. So I'd like to note that the slides focus on an IPO scenario, but the same analysis apply to a private sale. So on slide 24, you would see that there are 3 different group structures. In all scenarios, businesses A and B are controlled and wholly owned by parent B. So in scenario 1, businesses A and B are contained in a single legal entity. In scenario 2, businesses A and B are separate legal entities held by an intermediary entity, a holding company. In scenario 3, businesses A and B are separate legal entities directly under P. So we would like to highlight that even though the legal structure is different, the substance of the group is the same in all these scenarios. So moving on to slide 25, suppose the parent decides to sell businesses A and B in an IPO. So in scenario 1, businesses A and B can be sold together, as they are already contained in a single legal entity. In scenario 2, the businesses can be sold by selling the holding company. In scenario 3, the parent will first need to undertake a legal restructuring. So the parent could do the restructuring in a number of ways, as shown on slide 26. So the parent can merge entities A and B into a single legal entity, or the parent can create a separate new company that holds A and B. Or it could get A to acquire B or B acquire A. So moving on to slide 27. We noted that in all these scenarios, the economic substance remains the same. Businesses A and B are being sold to new investors. In particular, you may observe that scenario 3.1 is similar to scenario 1. Scenario 3.2 is similar to scenario 2. And therefore, we think that the information provided should also be the same, regardless of the legal form of the transaction. So in scenarios 1 and 2, the prospective investors will receive historical information about businesses A and B. Accordingly, we think that historical information about businesses A and B should also be provided in all sub-scenarios of scenario 3. So do you agree with these observations?
Anyone have any thoughts? I see James, you're nodding your head.
I'm just thinking, yes, it makes sense.
Yeah, I'll just try to make some comments to kick things off. What we're after, obviously, is hinted yourself, is the economic reality of what's going on needs to be reflected in any case, and that's the task. And I guess it's a challenge to come up with the direction in the accounting rules that get you there. I think to Marietta's point, we can't have the accounting rules wag the tail of the economic reality of the dog. So all these different, you don't want a company to sort of have the option to take any scenario to avoid or to subrogate sort of the economic reality of what's happening. It's a fairly obvious comment, but I think maybe you could highlight some of the... Oh, sorry. Yeah, Osman's got a question. Go ahead.
Again, this might be a really silly question. It's quite a complex subject, but I find myself agreeing with what you're saying here.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think back to our earlier discussion about, well, why do you then say we should use current value accounting for a business combination? Because that would destroy the historical information, right?
So if we look at slide 29, which we will not...
Well, thank you for your patience. Okay.
So as we said, we are looking at different sort of populations of users of this receiving entity financial statements and thinking about how different scenarios interact and which information is most useful where. And so here you can see that we are talking, when we talked about let's use current value approach versus let's use historical information, these are two different populations. So top left-hand side, if we have existing non-controlling shareholders in the acquiring entity at the time of the transaction, we think that current value information will tell them what's going on. If we don't have any existing NCI, we think that historical information is on balanced, best approach. Either if you have lenders and creditors, as we discussed, it sounds like, and we will come back to your comment about EV, but it sounds like you can work with both types of information. If there are prospective equity investors, as presented on slide 27, again, we think that historical information will be the best, and it will not allow the parent to choose how they move things around and then to choose what is at current value versus at historical cost. And then sort of they, again, looking back at slide 29, what we need to come back to and think about is really how we draw the line for those NCI transactions. So we've observed so far that at least in some cases for substantive NCI, it's current value approach. If there is no NCI, it's historical. But then, yeah, what happens sort of between this yellow dotted line and red dotted line, we still need to think about. So this is the big picture.
I have a different answer for that. Looking as we started doing from the receiving entity point of view, the P investors and the P management will never know whether it did a good deal or not. This is going to sell shares based on historical value of A and B in all differences. And then you had or may have a huge capital gain looking at your balance sheet because you didn't take into account the real value of your business, accounting-wise at least.
Are you talking about parents' accounts?
Yeah.
This is outside the scope. If I look at slide 9, what we're talking about is well outside the scope of the parents' accounts, right?
Yeah.
Because that's covered by IFRS 10.
Yes. And also, from the parent perspective, it is an intergroup transaction. All they've done, they moved things from one pocket to another. They don't really have an impact unless there are different sort of NCIs involved in different entities. Then there can be an effect, but normally it's intergroup transaction.
It's then you were talking about the business, and that's the case of the first scenario. You own 100% of two businesses within the same legal entity. You're right. I mean, I was assuming that you have NCI in all these scenarios.
Yes.
If you don't, then you justify not using current value accounting for these scenarios here. And then you explain the whole stack of slides. So when you don't have NCI, and then you use predecessor because there is no reason to step up costs.
Yeah.
Can I just make a comment, maybe clarification question? So I agree with what you have on slide 27, because in that case, you have P owning 100% of any of the available, you said, and that it makes sense to do historical cost because you don't want any of the evaluations to be shown before you go IPO. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I guess by 29, the reason for value when you have some third party, your non-controlling or non-related shareholders who own a piece of a company. And so in that case, you have to use current value. So I guess that's a comment. comment or clarification. I mean, that's the way we should look at it, correct?
I think, Rosemary, you're reflecting what the staff has said on the slide. You're absolutely right that where the only circumstances we're suggesting we'd use the current value is where there is a non-controlling interest in the receiving entity. And in all other circumstances, it would be using historic cost or predecessor approach.
If we go back to, I don't know if you don't really want to go back to question one, but I guess it's for my own. Or I can do it offline. The question then is one of how do you, I guess you could have different outcomes using the current value or where to Paul's point, you could have 49%. You could merge two companies. One is owned 49% and one is owned 51%. And the 49%, you would use current value and you would use historical value for total cost for your 50% company, or the company that you own 50% of the 51%. Correct?
We get that. Maybe
we follow. Yeah, can we? You're breaking up a bit on this one, Rosemary. So, can we? Do you mind if we follow up offline on the particular question?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Peter,
can I ask current value? Does that because we haven't given? I mean, we haven't sort of given it a face, right? Is that in some shape or form like a discounted cash flow model?
So current value approach, it would be something based on the requirement in IFRS 3. In IFRS 3, you measure all the identifiable acquired assets at fair value. So we might think about whether and how it needs to be slightly tweaked for the purpose of combination standards.
Sure, but the basic principle is we look forward cash flows, we discount them back, we get a number, right? So I've been trying to think here, under what circumstance would that not be better information for an investor in that company or even for a debt holder? Because I read the word there. It says debt holders, credit analysts are interested in cash flow analysis, which in my opinion is probably forecasting cash flows. So if we have a current value, which is in fact cash flow analysis, why could that not be better than historical book accounting metrics?
So just to be clear, it's not the cash flows of the entity that's been acquired. It's those cash flows attached to the individual assets that have been identified.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So cash flows that are likely on the
building,
brand.
A building in central London.
Yeah, exactly. So
a building in central London, historical cost, or we put it in there at current value.
Yep. So you end up with a smaller gap between that and the purchase price than you would with historic cost. So.
And again, I think it brings me back to my original comment, which I think applies in my mind, in particular to non-controlling shareholders, that of course, if we just look at what is better information, then fair value is better information. But then you need to take into account, okay, are there structuring concerns, are there cost-benefit concerns? So it's once you overlay the usefulness of information with those other considerations.
I fully understand what you're saying. It's just I was just trying from an informational perspective. If it's not just buildings in London, it's inventories, right? It's all kinds of things.
The building is a good example because if you take that at historical value, you probably will have to depreciate it based on historical value. And then you get all this ghost plus value flying in your balance sheet without being attached to anything. Right. It's not goodwill, but it's not the plus value of the building because you're not acknowledging that, recognizing that. And you have even a worse problem.
We've got a couple more cards that have popped up. Is that?
That's okay.
Okay. Philippe?
I'm just trying to understand the diagrams in slide 26 and 27. If A has a minority, does that mean that you'll get very different results under each of the scenarios because you'll be doing current cost accounting for A?
So just to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking what happens if we have both existing NCI and we are doing this transaction in preparation for an IPO? So that's one particular scenario which we need to come back and think about. And of course, if we were to sort of draw the line for NCI based on traded, non-traded, that question falls apart. If we did want to bring in some private NCI scenarios, that question will, we will have to deal with that. And we will need to decide, we will need to do further analysis, I suppose, because on one hand, you could argue that, well, for those existing non-controlling shareholders, fair value is a better information, but then there is a concern that parent can still choose how to move entities around, and then prospective equity investors get sort of mix and batch of some stuff is at fair value, some stuff at historical cost. So these are two things we still need to reconcile.
Okay.
Thank you. Terence.
A quick one. So in your view, the current value approach is better for the transactions that affect NCI. In terms of the value that those NCI, that the NCI gets using the current value approach, is that at a point in time, or is that the value that they're going to get being able to analyze those, the financials going forward? Like, are you talking about, when I think about a point in time, I mean the, you know, the acquisition analysis table where it shows the changes in the value and the calculation of goodwill, et cetera. Is that the main reason why you think it's better?
So you get fair value at the time of the transaction, but then it affects your ongoing amortization because it's going to be based on fair values rather than on historical amounts.
Yeah, it'll affect future results, obviously.
Yeah, but it's not periodic revaluation, if that's a question.
No. I know it's not periodic, but I mean, the reason why it's better for NCI is it because they get that reconciliation, they can kind of more clearly see what the consideration is going to and the value of the assets.
It's just, I don't think the reconciliation is required any longer, just between historic costs.
Showing the values of the assets.
It is about showing an up-to-date valuation of those assets that can be separately identified. Yeah, that's the argument, absolutely.
If that's the case, could you not just disclose that and could use perspective for everything?
That's another, that isn't, that is potential, that's, it is, it could be done, yeah.
Because if that is the value, then just put the disclosure in and then just have the same treatment across.
Okay, good. Marietta?
In terms of calculating current value, is there any reason why you are still considering tweaking IFRS 3? Because I think the last time we discussed it, the only really unanimous feedback was that, if it's either going to be IFRS 3 or, this predecessor method. But, people are familiar with IFRS 3. So if you now introduce some sort of IFRS light or whatever, I think, it would be very, very confusing for the NCI investors who think they're basically getting IFRS 3 and then they realize that it's a watered-down version that's maybe easier to apply or something. So I'm very concerned about this, and I'm just wondering, what is the thinking behind potentially?
And Marietta, I remember you making that exact same comment at the last meeting. I don't think it was unanimous feedback, but I did really hear your sort of view on that. And this is something we will be bringing back. But again, what we need to think about, if it is under common control, if you take a simple scenario, like as unlikely as it is, but let's say you paid less than what you acquired. So if it is between unrelated parties, you recognize this bargain purchase as a gain. If it is under common control, it's all directed by the parent. The economics is, just because it's under common control, it's not a gain, it's a contribution. So that's one potential modification that we are considering. So it's not a big difference. It's more about, does it go to P&L or does it go to equity? So this one is sort of an easy one. And I think economics are different if it's under common control. But then the next question that appears is, in IFRS 3, the whole model is based on the presumption, on the assumption that the exchange is at fair value. And that's why it's sort of supposed to work. And in a business combination under common control, the exchange is not necessarily at fair value. And then what happens if the acquired entity paid more than the acquiring entity paid more than the fair value of the acquired business? If we just apply for IFRS 3, it will be captured within the goodwill. And then at some stage, it it will be sort of subject to impairment testing. So I think because here we cannot rely on transaction being at fair value, we need at least to think about, is it possible to introduce some sort of screening mechanism to capture at least any obvious overpayments? So it's not necessarily IFRS 3 light, but maybe there is something just on top of IFRS 3. But it will be coming back for discussion.
Okay. Any other thoughts, comments? Okay.
Can I attempt to summarize, just so we are all on the same page?
Yeah.
We agree to use predecessor account.
So I think with NCI, with our first question, not so many comments, but I think we had one explicit support for our suggestion to explore traded, non-traded. We've heard one sort of explicit comment, sort of hesitation why we're starting with current value accounting to begin with. But generally, I think then later Philip said that no strong view on NCI because either type of information is workable. So I think it's something along those lines on NCI. I think with lenders and creditors, we did hear a little bit more support in relative terms for what we're proposing. So we need to come back to your comment about EV, and maybe we could take it offline just to make sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we've heard some support for what we're proposing, and certainly we didn't hear objections. And then for IPO scenario, certainly didn't hear objections. I think a degree of support to what we're proposing. Is that a fair summary?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We will be seeing you again.
Thank you. Okay. So on the mic's on.